Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're listening to Real College Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Schumacher. Okay, confession time. Even though I am the host of what is mostly a journalistic-based podcast, I am actually an English major. So beyond just podcasts, my other big passion is actually reading and writing. And I find that I especially love podcasts about reading and writing. And so, in that spirit, for the next two episodes of Real College Podcast, we are going to be exploring and talking about literature. In this episode, we'll mainly be focusing on poetry. I'm going to talk about my own favorite poem, as well as sit down with poet and creative writing professor Peter Campion to talk about some of his favorite poems. All that and more on this episode of Real College Podcast. Peter Campion is an American poet and a creative writing professor at the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities. I sat down with Campion to talk about his poetry and one of Campion's favorite poets, C.K. Williams.
I wanted to read a poem called Elms by C.K. Williams. He's a poet who died a couple years ago, and even though he was in his late 70s when he died, I was shocked and surprised and felt cheated. And he was such a wonderful and surprising poet. He seemed so young, no matter, even when he was writing about old age. He was so open to new possibility in his own work, to emotional vulnerability, to political conviction that he could convey in a way that wasn't just rhetorical or preaching to the choir. He also had an incredible vocal range, or just a sense of what the verbal energy of the English language can do in all its glory and all its range, from profanity to literary flourish and high style. And in his characteristic long lines, he was able to make drama out of different tones. And his sentences are always so dynamic. So I've been reading him a lot. I wrote a little something about him that's going to be in a prose book of mine, a book of essays. But I've been going back, even after that, to his poems and just enjoying them for their own merits, but hoping to take strange gain away, to have some influence. And, you know, however shadowy or strange, you know, influence can be more mysterious. We think of some works that are obviously influenced, but influence can also happen kind of through the back door in less obvious ways. And this is true, I think, of the way that experience affects art as well. C.K. Williams, I knew him a little bit, called him Charlie. That's just what his friends called him. He did influence me, I think, personally as well as aesthetically. I still think of his curiosity. I remember one time we were at a writer's conference in Ohio, and a woman who was there, a young woman, had these greyhounds that had been adopted from the track, you know, the adopt-a-greyhound programs or whatever. These beautiful animals, and Charlie was so interested in them, and he kind of developed a rapport with them, with these dogs, so quickly. And we had a conversation about dogs, and I don't know that he knew that they were from, like, the Save a Greyhound program or something. So he said something about one of these dogs. He said, "He's quivering, you know." And I said, "Well, maybe he's, like, scared of being hit." And Williams looked at me and said, "You're so cynical. That's crude." You know, he was pulling my leg in a way, but also it was wonderful literary criticism. You know, this is somebody who was not afraid of being called crude or vulgar, who wrote poems about sexual experience and embarrassing moments and divorce and topics that we'd expect from the therapist's office. And yet he had a really highly developed sense of tonal gradation, not just in his language, but in his regard for human experience and creaturely experience, dogs, the planet, the whole amplitude and range of color and delicacy and terror and strength and everything. Anyhow, that's a long spiel. I'll just read this poem, Elms, which is the first poem in a book of his called Flesh and Blood from the late 80s. Elms. All morning, the tree men have been taking down the stricken elms skirting the broad sidewalks. The pitiless electric chainsaws wind tirelessly up and down their piercing operatic scales, and the diesel choppers in the street shredding the debris chug feverishly, incessantly, packing truckload after truckload with the feathery, homogenized, inert remains of heartwood, twig, and leaf. And soon the block is stripped. It is as though illusions of reality were stripped. The rows of naked-facing buildings stare and think, their divagations more urgent than they were. The winds of time, they think. The mystery charged with fearful clarity. The winds of time. All afternoon, on to the unhealing evening, minds racing, insolent, unconscionable, the winds of time. You know, one thing that I admire about this poem a lot is how quickly it moves between this very specific, realistic physical description and this imaginary scene in which the houses are speaking, thinking out loud about the winds of time, and the play, therefore, that happens in tone in this poem between these two different ways of looking at the same scene that are related, one that's more literal and one that is more mysterious and subjective and fraught with emotion and concern about mortality. And Williams is able to do something that a lot of contemporary poets are up to, which is he's able to compare nature, in the largest sense of the word, the world outside of us, objects, processes, other people, trees, houses, and so on, with one's own subjective experience. And this is something that modernists tend to go in fear of. Most modern writers tend to be timid about what Ruskin called the pathetic fallacy, the projection of human emotions onto nature. And this is a poem which is able to do that at the end very powerfully and believably, because it's in part about that itself, about this kind of way in which our emotions and thoughts and concerns for our own being inflect our view of the world outside of us and vice versa. It's about that process, that negotiation between the self and the world, and between this somewhat dramatic kind of interior scene in which the evening is unhealing and minds are racing with this protest against insolent, unconscionable, the winds of time, mortality, destruction, and this seemingly normal neighborhood scene. It's kind of American Chekhov type scene.
One of the things that struck me about the poem was, even though the humans are the ones destroying nature, there's kind of, in the language of the poem, there's a futility to their actions. What he describes, the pitiless electric chainsaw, and their actions are described as feverish and incessant. Like, even though it's the humans destroying the nature, there's kind of this sense of that's all for nothing.
There's this moment where, in the middle of the poem, where in describing the work of the tree men are doing, he says, it is as though illusions of reality were stripped. And this is a hinge moment, which makes the metaphor explicit. It also intensifies the action, because it suggests there's an intensity, there's an urgency, there's a motive in this scene that is primal.
Also kind of that very kind of a modernist, definitely a post-World War I theme, where like humans are both the destroyer and the destroyed.
The thinker Simone Weil, who wrote kind of theological essays, also wrote a great essay on the Iliad. The Iliad is the poem of force, and she talks about the Homeric tradition, which does span through a poet like C.K. Williams, and that what one thing it does is it presents to us the dominion of force, of power, political military, existential, and shows us how to understand it but not to respect it, how to understand it but not to be enthralled to it, that this is Weil's view, what the Iliad does. I think that Williams's poems about violence, about ecological destruction, about war, are derived from a similar understanding of what poetry does. One thing I mentioned about that C.K. Williams poem, Elms, is the way in which it entertains the suspicion that maybe there's more kind of spiritual and animated life within the material world than we might guess, and at the same time doesn't give in to a kind of subjective fantasia. This poem is called Los Angeles River, and as you probably know, the L.A. River runs through Los Angeles. It's kind of fenced in most of the way in these concrete banks and is subject to powerful floods, but is often near dry. And this poem is called Los Angeles River. The concrete channel for flood control has nothing to control today but litter. Is it even wet down there? Some little puddles shimmer around the punk rock weeds, or else the shimmer's heat mirage. The city deals in heat mirage, dreams of arrival as a star streaming through canyon parties, dreams of pink Camaro flames released to flare from El Centro checkpoint. Right here could be where dreams end up. Film scattered on a concrete river. Some animal must have a home there in the weeds. Some creature's soul, probably rabid, must make do there, scavenging, claw to fang. Some urge, constant as blood or breath, must circle up from the faintest synapse fire to begin again, again, from way down, make it hurt, abandon. When I wrote that poem, I wrote it relatively quickly. I'm sure I revised it months afterwards several times. Afterward, I realized that, at least personally, part of what that seemingly very clear poem is about is being dry and yet knowing that there is some generative, creative life happening, that the muse will come back, praying for the muse to come back. In that poem, the muse is some kind of mysterious, grungy survivor of an animal in a kind of urban wilderness setting. So, you know, I think of that poem as kind of invocation or prayer to the muse, which sounds very high-minded and old-fashioned for a poem that is really kind of a photorealist portrait of modernity.
What strikes me about both poems is that they're both kind of responses to, they're like a conversation between nature in a city environment.
That's exactly right. And the response to the material, to the scene, to the situation and its elements, non-human life and contemporary urban environment, that these seeming opposites end up corresponding with a kind of tonal drama, a drama that happens both in the language shifts and in a shifting sense of reality. That at least that's my hope, and it certainly is what I find in Williams' poem, is that the poem kind of jimmies open this view into reality as having more depth and mystery and urgency than we might otherwise have expected.
Kind of along what you just said, another like comparison between the two poems is the fantasy and the point of interest in the poem comes in that conflict between urban and nature. The two poems kind of diverge in terms of the moral meaning being taken from that conflict between urban and nature. The Williams poem kind of looks at that divergence and sees mortality, and yours looks at that and sees survival, kind of like a future possibility. Yeah. And wondering if you could talk about the differences, but also the similarities in those two diverging paths.
I don't think it indicates some big ideological or existential or philosophical difference between two of us. I think it's probably just the effect of taking a tissue sample. You know, I mean, there are poems of mine that that are about facing mortality, and poems of Williams that are about the urge to survive, to keep going. But you're right, you know, and this brings up something important, which is Whitman famously writes, "Do I contradict myself? Very well, then I contradict myself." And I think that poetry, in a way that much media and much of the use of language we encounter doesn't, poetry allows for contradiction and for a kind of full-sidedness, a full depth of ambiguity, of difference, of taking together what we might, at least on the surface of our everyday lives, be accustomed to treat as separate, as categorically different types of feelings, different types of experience, different types of people, so on. That something poetry does is it jumbles up for us those categories. And this is something that Williams was very interested in terms of politics. I mean, he was an activist. He was strong anti-war conviction, strong environmental convictions, and didn't want to compromise those or didn't want to be embarrassed by them. On the other hand, he understood the way that art has to be open to uncertainty. And, of course, mottos and bumper stickers and soundbite arguments are the opposite, are not uncertainty. And he was able to write poems that had both depth, conveyed those situations and those emotions and political and global problems, but came at them with the imagination, which is ultimately going to be more powerful. Because people know, even if they expect to pretend to respect it or sit through it or whatever, people know when something is kind of rigged, when somebody has a set opinion or a stance or a rhetorical position. You know, that might not be bad in the world. And even in poems, some poems are built by argument. In fact, some great poems, but there's always going to be something that's going to, in a great poem, that's going to defy a kind of two-dimensional flattening of experience into format. You know, there's going to be something anarchic. I love the way that his political poems, well, I think my politics happen to be quite similar to his, in ways in which they're not just preaching to the choir, or they're not just good liberal sensibility or something. There's always something unexpected and wild in his work.
That was poet Peter Campion. He's a professor of creative writing at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, as well as the author of 3 books of poetry, including The Lions and El Dorado, both published through the University of Chicago Press. C.K. Williams was an American poet and critic. He died in 2015. He was the author of many collections of poetry, including Flesh and Blood, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award, and Repair, which won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. Finally, on this episode, on the topic of poetry, here's a piece I did earlier this year about my all-time favorite poem, The Wild Iris. I think sometimes books find people. They appear out of nowhere into your hands off some tucked away shelf. At least this is how The Wild Iris came to me. I was browsing the poetry section at Barnes & Noble when I found it. I'd heard of its author, Louise Glick, but I hadn't really read anything by her. But I decided to take a chance, so I bought it. It took me a few months to finally read it, but when I did, I devoured it all in one sitting. In the few weeks before I read The Wild Iris, I had just returned to campus after being hospitalized for 4 days because I was suicidal. It was during this few week period that I learned how to say things like, "I'm okay," when I felt like I was dying. "I'm okay." Learned how to put on a smile when I wanted to be anywhere. "I'm okay." But where I was. "I'm okay." Learned how to move through life so that everyone thought I was completely normal. "I'm okay." When inside I felt like nothing. "I'm okay." Unlike, say, breaking your leg, it's easy to keep depression a secret if you want. And because it's easy to keep it a secret, it's so easy to feel alone. like you're the only one in the world who feels the way you do. And so on its surface, The Wild Iris is just a collection of poems, mostly told from the perspective of flowers and other plants, but really it's so much deeper than that. Glick uses the voice of the plants to meditate on depression, loss, and ultimately survival. The collection's signature poem, The Wild Iris, is my favorite in the collection. Told from the perspective of an iris, it's about the flower's death in winter and then eventual rebirth in spring. The final lines of the poem, where the flower's blooming to life, are some of the most important lines of poetry I think I've ever read. Whatever returns from oblivion returns to find a voice. From the center of my life came a great fountain. Deep blue shadows on azure seawater. To be told that beyond depression, beyond loss, beyond the sense of emptiness, something beautiful would come from my life felt like hearing a radical prophecy. This message, these lines are so important to me that to honor them, I have a tattoo of a blue iris on my left arm. So that no matter how lost I feel, I can look at the iris and remember that there is a world of beauty waiting to burst out of me. From Real College Podcast, I'm Alex Schumacher. That's all for this episode of Real College Podcast. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It's produced by Nathan Fervoy, Ben Hallam, and Liv Riggins. Alex Schumacher, aka yours truly, is the host and managing editor. All episodes of Real College Podcast can be found online at radiok.org or wherever you get your podcasts. That's all for this episode of Real College Podcast. Until next time. We'll be right back.